We're going to be looking at Psalm 2 this morning, and I shan't read it at the beginning, but we'll be reading it as we go through in the service. But normally, by this time in December, I am fully in Christmas mode. Maybe not a Christmas jumper, but preaching-wise, I am visiting all of the familiar, obvious Christmas texts, not in a jaded way. I've become more excited about them as the years have gone by. I see new things in them every year. But this year, as we've just had the first election in December, the first Christmas election for nearly 100 years, and then there's Christmas just after it, I've sort of felt my mind being pulled in two different directions. I just wondered, was it possible to find a text that could bring these two events together, a general election and Christmas? And the answer, of course, to that is yes. It's not a matter of can you find one, it's a matter of which one you choose, because constantly God is talking about the authorities that exist here on earth and the king that he sent into this world. I suppose an obvious one would be Isaiah 9, verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, and of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end on the throne of David or over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will declare it. That's an open goal, isn't it? And yet I'm not going to use it. I'm going to miss it this morning, because I've already taken that text when we went to Netley Court a couple of weeks ago. And I'd like to try and do different texts for my own sake. And also I know that I think next Sunday morning they might be visiting part of that text. So we've got to leave something for them and then for Trevor on Sunday, Christmas Day morning as well. And so I've decided to use Psalm 2. It's an incredible psalm because it covers just about everything in 12 verses. If you look at it, it's the whole Bible in 12 verses. You've got the politics and the politicians and the citizens of this world. They're heard shouting out of it. Then you've also got the intervention of God through the king that he will send, who has the last word. So we're going to look at this psalm this morning, or better, we're going to listen to it. And it's the story of the whole of history told by four different voices. 12 verses, each of the voices takes up three verses as you go through. The first is the voice of this world, verses 1 to 3. And then secondly, you have the voice of Yahweh, the Lord who sits in the heavens, verses 4 to 6. And then you have the voice of his anointed, the Christ, Jesus, in verses 7 to 9. And then at the end, verses 10 to 12, you get the voice of a preacher who comes along and who says, now we've got to apply all of this. I've got to appeal to you. I've got to warn you. I've got to encourage you and urge you. So with all these different voices, I'm really redundant this morning. I can just let them do the talking. All I have to do is just tune you in to hear each of the voices. So let's start with the first voice. This is this world having its say, speaking very forthrightly about God. Verses 1 to 3, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords away from us. Now, some songs start quietly and they gently build up to their crescendo. But this one starts with great noise. It's discordant, isn't it? It's angry. It's raging. And it isn't about some local rebellion that was going on in Israel around 1000 BC. It's a worldwide thing. We've got the United Nations. They're coming together, consisting of all of the peoples. What is it that's uniting them? What one word brings everyone here on earth together? It's the word against, isn't it? Against the Lord and his anointed one, his Christ. And it doesn't matter whether you live in the 21st century AD or the 10th century BC. This is the common ground that humanity shares. It is against the Lord and his anointed. This voice was first heard singing this song on the pages of Genesis 3. When man said, I'm going to go against God. I'm not going to listen to God. And it's never shut up. You hear it all around you today. I hear it. I was part of the chorus singing it as loudly as I could for much of my life. And listen to what the world is singing. And whether you're a Christian or you're not a Christian, I think you'll have to agree this is entirely accurate. Let us burst there, that is God's bands apart or bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. What's that a picture of? It's a picture actually of a yoke. You know, not an egg yoke, but a yoke that would be put on oxen. And now maybe you think of a yoke as something burdensome, something restrictive and enslaving. And you're thinking, that's exactly what we need to do. That's what we want to do. We want to break those burdensome restrictions that God puts on us. We want to break that freedom-robbing, joy-sapping constraints of God. Let's break away from the religion of the past and get God out of our thinking. And out of our education system. And out of our legal system. And out of the structures of our society. Let's set our own moral compass. Why shouldn't we decide what's right and what's wrong and who we are and what we are? Let's be free from God. Well, that's I'm not making this up. That's what people want to do. But actually, the idea of a yoke is far more positive than maybe you've realised. Because what did a yoke do? It joined two beings together in harmony and enabled them to work together in harmony and to walk together in harmony and to share the load. And actually, what we're saying is not just we don't want God's commands, we don't want God's company. We don't want to walk in harmony with God. And if you're not a Christian, just reflect on that. I think you have to say that is an accurate picture of my life. I can make my own way without God. I'll live my life without being joined to him. I don't need him. I don't want him. I won't submit to him. I won't acknowledge him. I don't even believe in him. I'll live as if he isn't even there. I say to you, is that a good thing? Maybe you say, yes, it is. It's what I want to do. This is a real modern post-God age when we've got rid of this yoke, this idea of God. Well, if that's how you're thinking, I just point out that this isn't a particularly modern thing, is it? Because they were singing that very same song in 1000 BC. And they were singing it in Genesis 3. And it's not new and advanced. It's actually old, tired, and well-worn. And through all those long eras of singing it, have we actually found peace and rest and joy and satisfaction? Trying all the different other religions, all the different other philosophies, the different political views. Has it brought us that utopia that we long for? Do we find the meaning of life? Do we find confidence for the future, the short-term future, and then an eternal future by throwing away God? We sang in that first song. I didn't choose the song, so Dave did, and I was really excited again as something that I wanted to say just came out in that song. I was made to walk with him, the first verse. It's what you were made to do, to know God, to enjoy God, to walk with God. We've said we don't want to do it. We want to throw God's yoke away. Will your life against God, which maybe you think is going particularly well at the moment, will it be so good in 40 or 50 years' time? Will it be good when you're plunged into crises that are just too big for you, like many of us here have been? And you just wish that there was someone bigger that you were joined to, and you could walk through those days with him. Just over a year ago, I was stood in a little room in Southampton General, and Gloria, who was a member of our church here, she was in her last moments here on earth. And her life had been a struggle. I was really struck again how this ties in with Psalm 2, because she'd gone to church the first time angry and bitter. She hadn't gone to sing God's praise. She'd gone to bury God. She'd gone to prove that God did not exist. And Gloria on a mission was a scary thing. And she marched off to Spring Road to prove once and for all that there could be no God. Such was the pain and the anger in her life. And of course, God in his wonderful way found her and saved her and loved her and blessed her and took her through the difficult days. But she'd gone to church saying, "I will break his bonds asunder and cast away his cords from me." And she'd found a Jesus who'd said, "Come to me, find rest." And as she was passing away, what we were playing over and over again was Psalm 23 on YouTube, on my phone. What a blessing modern technology can be. And it was the words that said, "Yes, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you are with me, and your rod and your staff, they will comfort me." Do you want to get to that point in your life, still raging against God, still walking in the opposite direction? Or do you want to know the comfort that Gloria had, and that we have as Christians? Well, then kiss the Son, pay homage to him, worship him, trust him. There's another word, isn't there, that describes this angry rejection of God in the opening section. It's the word vain. They do it in vain. No matter how much you fight against God, no matter how loudly you speak against God, no matter how long you live against God, you will not win, because God won't stop being God. And a life lived against God is empty and vain and ends in defeat. You might not like to hear that. It might make you want to shout louder. But it won't destroy God, because secondly, we've got the voice of Yahweh in verses 4 to 6. "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. And he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, 'As for me, I've set my king on Zion, my holy hill.'" So as here on earth, all the poles show the opinions stacked against God. As we lift our voices and we shake our fists and we say we shall overthrow God, is God taking any notice of our polls? Is God threatened? Does God think he needs a new spin doctor to help him out of this problem? Well, the psalm tunes us into heaven and we hear laughter. As the world brings all of its learning and its strength and its brilliance together to oust God from his universe, God holds them in utter derision. It's pathetic. It's pitiful. It's humbling. And if he so wishes, and one day he will simply speak in his anger, and all opposition will fall in terror before him. But is that all that God does? Does he just laugh at our arrogance and hatred and then bring down his judgment? Well, that would be justice, and yet God is not only just. This God is also kind. And he's merciful. And he does something amazing here. He says into the rebellion of this world that says we will not have God, he says, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. His king is not the king over God. It's the king that God has given, that he sends to bring in a new kingdom and a new way. And I think that's lovely. Instead of giving us the day of judgment, he gave us the first Christmas. And he sent his son when the word became flesh and dwelt among us. When the Son of God was manifest in the flesh, born of a woman, born into our race. And he humbled himself and came into the noise and the rebellion of this world. Emmanuel was here. God is with us. People in the Old Testament era, they knew that the Christ was going to come. But they didn't always grasp exactly what he was going to do, because they thought he would immediately bring an end to all of the rebellion. And it would be the day of his judgment and everything would be finished. All enemies were going to be then destroyed. And yet, when this king came, he didn't get born in a palace. He was born in a stable. He wasn't born into opulence and plenty, but abject poverty. He became a refugee. He grew up in despised Galilee of the Gentiles. And instead of going around judging everything and smashing everything with an iron bar like a potter's vessel, he went around mending and taking shattered vessels and putting them back together, and broken hearts and healing them. He was kind. He revived that which was flagging. And people must have thought, surely this isn't all that God's promised, is it? He should be doing some swinging around of the iron bar. Even John the Baptist was confused. Dave was telling us about. They got to a point when John sent some messengers to Jesus and he said, "Are you the Christ, or shall we wait for someone else?" He's really indignant. He's saying to Jesus, "Will you hurry up, please, and do something?" And so Jesus did something. Luke 7, verse 21. In that very hour, he healed many of their diseases and plagues and evil spirits. And on many who were blind, he bestowed sight. And he answered them, "Go and tell John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive their sight. The lame walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. And the dead are raised up. And the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who's not offended by me." He was God's king in action. So mighty that he can smash the world, and yet so gentle and kind that he was here first of all to save the world. Didn't you get a clue about that in the first ever sermon that Jesus preached? When he preached from Isaiah, he took the scroll Isaiah 61, and he read out these words, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has entrusted me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Everybody who knew Isaiah, which they would have known very well in the first century Jewish culture, would have been expecting Jesus to carry on, and he didn't carry on. He rolled up the scroll, he handed it back, he sat down, because they sat down to preach then. And he said, "Today, this is fulfilled in your presence. This is the year of God's favor." If Jesus had read the next sentence, actually it's not a sentence, it's mid-sentence he broke off. If Jesus had finished the sentence, what would he have said? "And the day of vengeance of our God." But Jesus didn't read that yet. He broke off mid-sentence. He's put a great gospel pause in here because there's a day of grace before there's a day of vengeance. And to come back to Psalm 2, which has this great picture of it all, the king who comes and who does all of these things, who brings in the final judgment, but also saves. When, in his first appearing, did God set his son, his king, on a throne on Zion's hill? When did Jesus wear a crown? When did Jesus hold a scepter? When did Jesus wear a beautiful robe? It was when they were about to crucify him. And the crown was a crown of thorns. And the throne was a cross on which he was lifted up to bear the penalty and the wrath of God for the sins of his rebellious people. This great God had sent his son to the rebels, not first to destroy and to judge us, but to die and save us. He'd sent a king, Jesus, a savior, not to drive us away from God, but to bring us home to God. To say to the weary and the lost and the restless who were spending their lives trying to break God's yoke, what did Jesus say? "Come to me, all you who are laboring and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And then thirdly, we hear his voice in the psalm, and it's the voice of Jesus. Verse 7, "I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I'll make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel.'" Again, as we just look at the words as we see them in Psalm 2, we might be confused. Is Jesus here to save the world or to smash the world? Is he here to gather the nations in or to destroy everything? Well, you've got to remember, it's a matter of timing. But he's declared to be the Son of God. When? Well, I think probably throughout his life. As he's born and Mary holds him in her arms, God says, "Let all the angels of God worship him." Hebrews 1, we were looking at a little while ago, because he's the Son. There were times in his life when God just ripped open heaven and he wanted to shout down to us, "This is my beloved Son, you listen to him." There was a time though on the cross when we might have wondered, was he really the beloved Son of God? As darkness enshrouded him, and in despair and loneliness and dereliction, he shouted out to his Father, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" But he is the Son. And he was being forsaken for us so that we could become sons and daughters. And 3 days later, what did that resurrection declare about him? Romans 1 declared to be the Son of God in power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by his resurrection from the dead. And having risen as the faithful, victorious Son who's won salvation for his people, he says, before he ascends to heaven to his disciples, all authority and all power in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Now, I want you to go out and tell the world about this, but not quite yet, because timing is so important to Jesus. Because there's a bit of Psalm 2 that I have to just now take back to my Father. And he ascends, and he goes to his Father, and I'm sure he said, Father, you said, ask of me, and I'll give you the nations as your inheritance, the ends of the earth as your possession. And what does the Father do? He pours out the Holy Spirit on the church, and the gospel age dawns in all of its glory. It's an era of salvation, but there's still a reminder of a future day of judgment. He will reign till he's put all of his enemies under his feet, and all opposition will finally be shattered as Jesus returns and restores all things, raises the dead, and drives out all that is sinful and rebellious. And finally we get the society that we'll never ever get here on earth until Jesus returns. And so finally we have a fourth voice. It's the voice of a preacher. Verses 10 to 12. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. That means reverence. Not terror, but respect and reverence. And rejoice, he says, with, and I prefer the old translation here. I don't like trembling so much. I like awe. Rejoice with awe. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled, but blessed are all those who take refuge in him. Let me ask you, please, will you rejoice with awe this Christmas? You can be a cynical old lot. We all can. And it's something we see so often, it's a story we hear so regularly. Can you rejoice with awe? As again, you hear the story of that child held in Mary's arms, who is your creator. Come here to be your redeemer, your God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. Will you rejoice in all that he was manifest in the flesh to become your brother, to stand with you, to represent you, never ever to let you go? Will you rejoice with awe as you follow him in action in the Gospels, stilling the storms, healing the sick, feeding the hungry, freeing the enslaved, befriending the lonely, bringing hope to the hopeless and the written off, touching the untouchables and preaching good news to the bankrupt? Will you rejoice with awe when you realize that that child, so pure and holy, was born to be the man who'd go to the cross and instead of breaking you, would be broken for you? Will you rejoice with awe as you trace the story of Christmas to that cross and God your Maker hangs his head and dies for the sins of these rebels? You're not so jaded and old that that doesn't move you. And will you rejoice with awe as 3 days later, this Son, this King, rises from the dead and leaves it smashed and trampled, your greatest enemies slain, your greatest fears removed, hope and confidence given to you, Will you rejoice with all that 2,000 years later, still Jesus is saying, come. Come to me, all you ends of the earth, and be saved. That's what I asked my Father for, the ends of the earth as my possession. I often say it, Netley feels like the end of the earth sometimes. Therefore, it's definitely within the context of the gospel. You come to him today and be saved. Become part of his family, part of his inheritance. Take refuge in him and be blessed. So, kiss the Son. That's a weird thing to say in the 21st century. Really means love him. Bow before him. Trust him. Submit to him and respond to his wonderful invitation to walk with you through life. What a Christmas you'll have. That beats a box of black magic, doesn't it? What a Christmas you'll have. What a life you'll have. What an eternity you'll enjoy. But there's one voice, a fifth voice, that the psalmist has left out. Quite deliberately. And it's your voice, isn't it? What are you going to say in response to God? The psalmist can't add that voice. I can't add it. Only you can. But do you love Jesus? Will you trust Jesus? Will you be joined by faith to Jesus? Or are you going to carry on walking alone? Only you and God can know that. I urge you, as the preacher does here, to rejoice with all, to serve the Lord, to come and submit to the King and be saved by him. Amen.